It always wears me out when Carol wears pink instead of her leather, and it's just kind of freaks me out. How many of you can identify that there is a promise or a covenant that is active in your life? Someone made you a promise a while back and hasn't been made true yet, hasn't been paid out yet. It's still active. Anyone can think of anyone? I had, in one of my former churches, there was a really rough group of guys. I was young as a youth worker, and the guy who was mentoring me said, "Do you want the good kids or like the bad kids?" And I was like, "Oh, I'm here for Jesus, man. Give me all the bad kids." So I have this gang of street thugs. This is the group that pulled a knife the first Bible study they had. But later on, they got to be a small group. They got to be this incredible guys group, and they really liked being a part of this guys group together. And these guys were the kind of guys who were like, no holds barred. If they thought it, they would say it. You have a booger. You know, it's just, you are me. Like, if they thought it, they said it. If someone was fronting, they would call you out on the spot. Someone was pretending to be something they weren't. If you were evidencing behavior that they disapproved of, they would call you out on the spot. Not only with each other, which was great because this is a Christian Bible study small group, but they would also do it with God. I don't think God is like that. Or I don't understand why God does that. Or I don't think he says that or whatever. Anyway, we get to the point where they graduate, and so we wanted to celebrate. So we had an overnighter, which was pretty much every weekend with these guys. And it was around 3 or 4 in the morning, and they're not drunk because I'm there. But this guy stands up. Jeff is tall, awkward. He's always wanted to be like that number one kind of guy, but he's really like number 4, number 5. And so he stands up in this grandiose manner and gets the guy's attention. Guys, I'm giving each of you one life favor. I don't care how many years go by. You need a lot of money, I'm good for it. You need help with a job or with a woman or something, I'm there for you. And the guys are looking around like, what is, okay, whatever, Jeff. And he goes, guys, you need a dead body buried, I'm your guy. So this covenant is active in my life. And I pray that none of those guys have ever had to call Jeff for help with that. God has made us promises. We have covenants active in our life. We have promises from God that are active in our life today. And I don't know if it's that we take them for granted or if we're just unaware of them. It's a little bit like saying, I don't know if I have a suitcase full of winning lottery tickets. And so therefore, I just go about life, just, you know, I can afford anything I want to. I don't care. I'm just carefree. Is it that? Or is it, I don't know, that I've got the winning lottery ticket in my pocket. I just don't know it. And so I go about my life grinding it out day by day in toil and agony and hardship. We have promises from God. There's a backdrop to today's message. It's Genesis chapter 12. It reads like this. Well, first of all, this is a foundational covenant passage to all of human history. These verses are like an eternal moment in mankind's history, and the depths of which I don't have time to go through today, but for those of you who want to sink your teeth into something really meaty and deep and theological, look up covenantal theology. It starts with this passage. In a gross oversimplification, I'll say it this way. This passage changed everything forever. Verse 12. No, verse 1 of chapter 12. The Lord said to Abram, go from your country, go from your people, go from your father's household to the land I will show you. Abram, I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. And whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Singular you, Abram. You, this man who exists in time and space on this earth, through you I will bless everyone. One scholar puts it this way. With Abram commences the story of God's creation of Israel, a story in which God will reveal his freedom in being merciful to Israel, his holiness in judging Israel, his faithfulness in restoring Israel, and his absolute sovereignty over all of human history forever. And it starts here. So that's the backdrop. Abram receives this covenant from God and goes about his days. 10 years later, we get to Genesis 16, and here's the fun part of the passage. Genesis 16, verse 1. Now, Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. But she had an Egyptian slave named Hagar. And so she said to Abram, "The Lord has kept me from having children. So go and sleep with my slave. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Abram agreed to what Sarai said. So after Abram had been living in Canaan for 10 years, Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian slave Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar and she conceived. There's some cultural background in play here. For those of you who are Bible scholars, for those of you who have been in church all your life, you've heard this passage before. Okay, so what's next? For those of you who've never heard this passage, you're saying, what in the world just happened? She did what? Is that okay? Is that allowed? Back then, yes, this was completely normal. Infertility was a catastrophe back then. Survival of the family was paramount through male children. Job number one of every family, have a male child. Have a male child. Have many male children. Job one of every wife, job one of every husband, secure the dynasty of the family. But there was also personal and social ramifications. If you, a woman, were infertile, then the rest of the women in the household and the community and your husband and everyone else sort of suspected that you were indecent and immoral, and that's why you don't have children. And finally, the third point, Sarai and Abram have been waiting for 10 years for God to make good on his covenant with them. Which, okay, doesn't sound all that long unless you realize that Sarai at this point is 75 years old and Abram is 10 years her senior. They're 75 to 85 years old waiting for a child to come. There are some disturbing images about what is happening. And to the unfamiliar ear, was polygamy and surrogacy common in that time? Yes, yes it was. There's a discussion and a meditation prompt in your email and in the YouVersion app, which you can explore later on polygamy and surrogacy. And by the way, if you don't have an email from us this morning, then you need to get on our email list. Go down in that YouVersion app, the QR code's on your pew and on the screen next to you, and sign up on that connection card. We give some good stuff to the emails. We don't spam you. It's good stuff. But in short, polygamy and surrogacy, any child of the household born to any woman, slave or free, wife or not, any woman who gave birth who was impregnated by the husband, that child became the child of the first wife. That's the standard of the culture back then. So Sarai is completely within bounds of what's happening. It's weird, but it's completely within bounds. The problem is that Sarai is tired of waiting on God. And she focuses on the object of the covenant. A child, a child, a child, a child, a child. She forgets that every covenant is about God and the person. It's about a relationship. She focuses on the object, the thing. So, Sarai being Sarai, she takes the matter into her own hands. She's a problem solver. She is a doer. She's action-oriented. She gets stuff done. And in so doing, she doesn't think to ask God whether or not it's the right path. It's a little bit like just asking God to bless the choice that we're going to make. God, I'm going to do 120 miles on this highway. You better bless me. I'm not sure that's the right choice to make. God, I'm about to eat this incredibly over-large giant steak with loaded mashed potatoes, 3 appetizers and 2 good desserts and this really awesome drink, about 4 days worth of calories in one meal. So God, bless it to my body. For my students, it's like praying in desperation before a test. God, help me, help me, help me. But you know that you have cheated on every single homework assignment and you haven't studied at all. And so you're asking God to retroactively bless all of those choices and somehow right now, just bless me, please. Just have me, it's all gotta be C. God, make every answer C. It's like asking God for financial blessing. It's like asking God for financial blessing, which is really asking God to retroactively bless your selfish expenditures, even though you didn't give back in financial offering to God in the weekly practice of sacrificing and putting to death this idol of money in our lives. It's not a one-to-one. It's not like if I give God the money, then he's going to give me more money. That's not how that works. It's if I recognize that God is God and not money, then my life goes better. If I recognize that God is God and my life is better for following God and everything in my life is subject to God's sovereignty, then I can give him my offering in freedom and knowing that I'll be blessed. Asking God to bless things with after we've already made our choices is backwards. It's we are God and he is the magic jinn that just kind of sprinkles fairy dust on our choices. How many of us just ask God to bless our sinful choices? The answer is all of us. We are all sinful. We should absolutely be doing this and yet also be working to align our lives better with God's covenant, with God's promises, so that our choices are better, so that our blessings are more real, so that our blessings are more obvious and visible and seen. Sarai can't have a child. I know this is really hard for some of you who are in real distress. Maybe it's infertility. Maybe it's dealing with your own or a loved one's long illness. It's waiting for someone with an addiction to finally shake it. It's some other deep, dark issue. If you are in this place today, there is hope in this passage. Stay with us. But let me ask you this. Is there a promise, Pathways? Is there a promise from God that our church, that we are waiting on and hoping on and praying for and desperate to see answered? Is there anything in which we need and depend on the supernatural to show up? There's a joke in seminary where, like, pastors should put themselves into situations where our prayer is, okay, God, I have obeyed you, and now I'm here, and if you don't show up, really bad things are gonna happen. Are we as a church following God in such a way where we need him to show up, otherwise bad stuff's gonna go down? I was being counseled by one of Pathways leaders this week, And they expressed a thirst to see God present in our everyday lives, in the reality of what we are trying to do as a church, and in how we operate every day, day by day. Is there something we're desperately waiting for? Something we're desperately trying to do and waiting on God to show up and do the thing? What promises from God are we holding on to? Because they are many and they are there. I think there's a lot of room for growth in us, for us in this. Whichever person is being asked to be our next senior pastor, that's got to be job one or two, right up there at the top, is they have to reassemble the strategic planning team. They've got to really assemble a team who will do this, who will seek God out, who will be on their knees for us as a church and say, we believe that God is asking us to go forward in these three areas, these five areas, for 3 to 5 years. We're going to go hard after these things, and they're big enough where if God doesn't show up, we're going to be in trouble. Or are we running church by our own human standards? We don't really need God. We can just do this. That's not a church that any one of us wants to belong to. We worship the living God who is present and real and active and changes things in the everyday. Let's move on. In verse 4, the last part of 4, when she, Hagar, knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. Sarai said to Abram, you are responsible for the wrong that I am suffering. I put my slave in your arms, and now that she knows that she is pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me. Your slave is in your hands, Abram said. Do with her whatever you think best. So Sarai mistreated Hagar, such that Hagar fled from her. It's a lot. It's a lot to say about Abram's weakness in this passage. But he's not really the focus of today's message. But if he was, I'm imagining like this 1990s or 2000s sitcom where that formula where they had the clueless dad as the joke of every sitcom. And so Abram's kind of sitting here like, you told me to, why am I in trouble? What? And Sarai's just like, I did this, and now you're in trouble. Well, okay. But he did not stand up. And she's bleeding everywhere. But Hagar is not innocent. Let's count this down, right? She began to despise her mistress. Hagar committed the very predictable sins of arrogance and envying the first wife status. She went from slave to wife. She went from wife to mother, and therefore is honored, and that looked very good to her. People started to treat her differently. Abram started to treat her differently. All the household started to treat her differently. Maybe this is my position now. Hagar committed the sin of ignoring her direct boss, Sarai, and trying to curry favor with her boss's husband. That doesn't work well even today. Hagar committed the sin of just trying to replace Sarai. And so predictably, Sarai is having none of that. And whatever she does to Hagar, it's intolerable. I want you to keep in mind how bad this must have been. She's a slave. She's not from this land. She's alone. She's not married to anyone except for Abram. It's bad enough. Whatever Sarai is doing to her, it's bad enough for Hagar to say, it's better for me to die in the desert. Whatever was going on was so bad, she couldn't stay. Some of you are in the same darkness. Maybe you feel like you are alone in the wilderness. Maybe you feel like you're dying in the desert. You're in a place, possibly, that causes you to question God's reality, or maybe even the point of living. Many of us have had this story as part of our lives. I haven't told you my full testimony. It is definitely a part of my life. please, if you are here, we ask you to stay with us, to be in this passage with us, to hear the hope in this passage that is soon coming, and to ask for help. Find one of us. Don't walk through this alone. Hagar's out there. Verse 7. The angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. You know, it's that same spring that's beside the road to Shur. I mean, you all know this. And so the angel said, Hagar, slave of Sarai, where have you come from? And where are you going? I'm running away. I'm running from my mistress Sarai. And I imagine the angel looks at her. And because scholars believe this was the pre-incarnate Christ who was really visiting with Hagar, I believe that there's a look that passes between them. I believe she finds love, acceptance, and restoration in this look. And so the angel says, go back. Go back to your mistress and submit to her. And I'll give you this. I will increase your descendants so much that they will be too numerous to count. She just got a promise from perhaps God himself of the very same nature that Abram got. Remarkable. By the way, that passage about the spring beside the road to Shur, it's a weird part of the passage. You don't put it in fables. You don't put it in moral stories. You don't put it in stories meant to put children to bed. You only put that kind of detail in historical data. This really did happen. There really was a woman named Hagar. She really was on the spring, on the road to Shur, by that one spring that everyone knew. There really was an angelic being, possibly God himself, who appeared and spoke to her. And by the way, the geography also tells us something else. It gives us a little bit of the distance between where Abram was and where she is now. It's about a week. She's on her feet in the desert, alone, no food, no money, no man, hiding from men. She's been walking alone in the desert for about a week, pregnant. But note that God, even though he has plans to intervene, he allows Hagar to reap the consequences of her wrongful actions. He didn't stop her half an hour after she left. He didn't take her and magically transport her somewhere. He didn't magically give her everything that it was, go back. It was, what are you doing? It was a week later. And even the way he addresses her, he doesn't call her the second wife of Abram to fit the majestic title in her head that she was gunning for. He calls her Hagar, the slave of Sarai. And maybe that's just like gently remind her of where he wanted her, to gently remind her of her part of the wrongness in this situation. There is a misconception among my students. There's a misconception among Generation Z that says that perfect love means complete and total acceptance. If you love me, you accept everything about me. But that's not actually love. That's abuse. If I have a pet and I let my pet cat become 98 pounds, that's abuse. I accept that my cat just wants to keep eating, so I'm not going to, he should just eat. Here, here's more, just eat, just keep eating. That's abuse. Perfect love is modeled by God. And his love for us is complete acceptance, but it's also correction and accountability. You see it here. He calls her by her rightful name. He doesn't rescue her and magically transport her and give her a chariot of fire and give her riches and wealth and whatever. He doesn't make her life perfect. He lets her bear the consequences of her actions and says, the best thing for you, Hagar, is to go back in humility. Go back and apologize. Go back and be humble. Go back and be a servant again. Go back and earn the good favor. Go back and reorient the right character that I know that is in you. Go back and do the work. This is your consequence. And you notice that God started with that question of, Hagar, from where have you come and where are you going? God does that. He does it a lot. He does it to Adam and Eve. He does it a couple times in the Bible. Where have you come from and where are you? Like, he doesn't know. It's got to be more than that. It's not a question of geography or destination. It's got to be his first test. It's got to be, tell me, my child, how do you see the situation you're in? What's really going on, my child? It's like the wise grandfather talking to. It's like the wise mentor saying, tell me how you see the situation. Let's start there. There's a theme of seeing that God is playing with in this whole passage. But I want to note this. Hagar did not have to respond to God. She is, first of all, a foreigner. She is an Egyptian, not an Israelite. She is a foreigner in a strange land, and we are a multicultural church. Many of us know what that struggle is. To not speak the language, to not know the culture, to be considered an outsider, to not be let in, to be considered something other. She knows what that's like. She's a servant with all of those hardships. She has no rights or standing. She can be looked down upon. She can be told to do things that she doesn't like to do. She is given to someone that she did not choose, and she is forced to bear a child and then forced to give up that child. She has been abused and discarded and pretty much expelled from her home and her safety and her security. She has nothing to her name. She has no goods. She has no owner. She has nothing. And she has no prospects for survival. She could just as easily have been on the side of this road and angry at God and angry at the world and never answering the God who calls out to her. We each know people whom we love, and it seems like they can't sink any further, and yet they still don't answer when God calls them, and our soul cries out and says, what will it take? But Hagar answers. Hagar's not in the line of blessing. She has no right to be talked to by God. Indeed, she gives birth to the generations that will oppose God's people for millennia to come. But God still shows up for her, and God still blesses her. There is something very complicated in this passage that we would do well to study further. But I want to just say it this way. Today, in this room, some of you discount yourselves as being strong Jesus followers. When someone up here talks about a leader, or those of us who are invested, and those whom God is using to powerful effect, you look around at other people. Perhaps God today is saying to you, just as he said to Sarai, and to Hagar, no, no, I'm calling to you. I see you. And Hagar's blessing from God is not about her own benefit. It's not about deliverance or rescue or safety like it is in America. God's blessing for Hagar is to always point us back to serving him, serving others, and to serving other Jesus followers. Here's the best part. Here we go. Verse 13. Hagar is talking to this angel who is probably God. She chooses to answer, and she says this. Scripture says this. This verse doesn't exist anywhere else in Scripture. It only exists right here. Hagar gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her. You are the God who sees me. I have now seen the one who sees me. That's the first time that has ever happened in history. God speaks to nations. God speaks to people groups. God speaks to special prophets. She's an Egyptian slave woman who has done some things wrong. God is blessing her, and God allows her to name him. You are the God who sees me. That's the only time ever in Scripture anyone's ever said that sentence, anyone's ever been allowed to name God, and he accepts it like a proud father. You are the God who sees me. And she speaks about God in a one-to-one ratio. I know for us today in the church age, it's like, okay, so big whoop. This is the God who spoke to the UN. He only speaks to giant groups of people. Occasionally, he might speak to a world leader. But this woman on the side of the road establishes a personal relationship with God and says, I see that you see me. Not me, my people, me. This is what we're after, Pathways. This moment. For all of our loved ones who don't know God yet, for them to be able to say in complete marvel, in complete joy, in complete satisfaction, in complete deliverance, I see the God who sees me. Theological truth from a woman. Theological accuracy from someone outside of God's people. It's a pivotal event of personal theology from someone who was unstudied and unskilled in divinity. Hagar is not in our list of biblical heroes, but for this moment, she should be. She's the first one in all of history to practice her faith the same way that we practice our faith. So what? Okay, Donna, that's a cool passage, but so what? Well, it got written down in the Bible, so she had to tell someone about it. She told her story. Some of us are in stories of present pain. We invite you to tell us your story. Find someone here and say, hey, I'm walking this thing alone and I need help. Can I take you out for coffee? Can you have a meal with me? Can I talk with you after service? Will you pray with me? Just share your story. Some of us carry with us old wounds that are never really quite healed. And it's not quite healed because that final piece is you talking with someone else who will help you process forgiving someone else or asking for forgiveness and turning that part of your life back over to God. You need to tell your story. Some of us are about to run headfirst into a consequence of pain, and you need to tell your story, otherwise bad things are going to happen. This is why all of my students need mentors. This is why the V team is skilled in one-on-ones. So we can hear their story and say, you know, maybe you want to consider a different choice here. What if we had a library of like 30-second, 1-minute, 3-minute, 5-minute stories? Just a lot of them. From the very mundane and ordinary to the extraordinary, that just talked about Jesus in our lives. You know, most churches, they post social media about this event that they're having or that event, come to this event, come to that event. It's just a PR marketing campaign for any other business out there. The one thing that's different about us is Jesus. And if we can't tell stories of Jesus in our life, then we have a lot of growth to do. I just found this new app. I think it's really cool. I'm going to tell everybody I know about this new app because it does really cool things. But the Jesus who was core to my life. I just found this cool restaurant that I'm definitely going to take some friends to. But a story about Jesus in my life. I just found this cool whatever. And I'm going to tell everybody. But we need to grow in telling real time, real life stories of Jesus in our life. This is what we need to be known for. This, my own children, your children, other children, future generations, they can say whatever they want to about God and Jesus and about Pathways, but they won't be able to say, they'll be able to say that Pathways, they walk with Jesus. There's something weird about those people. They have stories about Jesus that are just kind of hard to deny. Okay, I've heard one or two stories, but 10 of them, 50 of them, just what if our website was just, what's it like to follow Jesus? Boom, 30-second video. Boom, 2-minute video. A TikTok, whatever, on all these, how do we follow Jesus? Maybe it looks a little bit something like this.
My name's Evan Yamada, and this is my story. God and church was nowhere near my life when I was growing up, and turned to other things and started in high school and got into drugs and alcohol at a pretty young age, and that carried me all the way till college. Then I started to isolate and started thinking about suicide, made about 3 different plans of how I was going to do it. I was all the way down to the bottom to where I was in my upstairs bathroom and so afraid of friends and my parents that were trying to help me.
My name is Tara Burns and this is my story. Growing up, we didn't live in like a Christian household. We weren't forced to read the Bible or go to summer camp or anything. My dad actually, his parents were from a Buddhist temple and my mom went to Catholic school. So anything was kind of goes with religion. And I remember in college, I was talked to by 2 girls that were on my dorm floor and they told me that if I didn't accept Jesus Christ right then and there, that they couldn't be friends with me and that I was going to hell. So I pretty much avoided Christian kids after that.
Hello, I'm Jack Rowell, and this is my story. It was probably 15 years ago. I was a pretty big partier, living in LA, and I was a believer, but I wasn't sure what I was a believer in. Then my niece passed away, and I was so mad at God and even doubted that there was a God if something like that could happen. And just quit drinking, just put it down. I was tired of it, thought this was going to fix my life, and it didn't. I was still searching.
I gave Christ my life, and Christ saved me from so much despair and so much agony, and has given me so much hope and motivation and a reason to keep moving forward.
So after I was saved, became baptized, got involved with a small group, and I'm doing things to help me walk with Jesus and hopefully get other people to walk with him also.
In 2007, I was baptized by my fiance, and it was an amazing experience to look across the room and see people who truly love and care about you. I finally knew what was important in my life.
Here's Here's the challenge for you. If you would consider yourself not really a Jesus follower, well then, just shoot that video. It's 30 seconds. Just film yourself saying, why are you here? Like, there was something you're interested in. There's something why you came. Like, I came because my parents made me come here. Whatever, we don't care. It's great. Just tell your story. There are others like it. It'll be easiest for you because that's an easy assignment. If you would consider yourself a mid-level Jesus follower, like, okay, I'm not like mature, spiritually wise, all that, but I've been following Jesus for a while and I think I'm, you know, I know some stuff. There are discussion questions and meditation questions. Go through some of those. They're harder this week, but that's okay. And then tell us your story. Send us that video of where you're at. If you consider yourselves, I am, this church considers me spiritually mature and a leader and whatever, then you need to A, go through these questions, B, you need to tell us your story, and C, you need to go ask someone else to tell them, go find someone else's story and shoot a video with them or something. Pathways. Our whole job from God was to go and tell his story. And that's best told through our stories. Sarai is in pain. Hagar is in pain. And for whatever reason, this passage stops here and says that just meeting God was enough. There was something in his covenantal promise. There was something in saying, I see you, that got her to the next place. Worship team, come on up. Let me pray. For me, God, it's oddly both and. I walk around my life like I have a suitcase full of lottery tickets and I'm just kind of careless about it. But I also, oddly enough, feel like I have to grind it out. There are some days where I'm not sure if I'm earning your favor and grace or if I'm living in the joy and the rest of it. It's a weird contradiction. Sin is present in our lives, God. All sorts of bad theology about earning it and living up to this and being worthy of that, and all of that is just junk in my head. And yet there's also not, it's not exactly the children's version where if you accept Jesus then everything will be better. That is so much incredibly true, and yet you are the God who still asks and challenges and demands. This following you thing is the greatest joy and the hardest thing, the simplest thing. It is my reward, it is my struggle. You, God, are wonderfully complex and difficult and just in my life. And we pray that for those whom we love, for those whom are hurting, for those who are on the side of the road. God, visit with them. Would you let them know in a powerful and tangible and undeniable way that you are right there with them? I don't understand how a pregnant single woman on the road for a week didn't get molested or hurt or whatever, whatever. So God, you must have sent people to her to help her. In the same way, God, will you send us to be hyper aware of those around us who are hurting? We do this thing where we're present at the beginning and then after a couple days or a week or so, we drop off and go back to our regular day-to-day. And we know that in our heads that pain is longer than that, but our bandwidth is so short. Father, would you transform pathways into the place of caring, into a place of loving, into a place of stories that range from completely confused to completely celebratory, from completely in the mix of hardship to the complete freedom from a hardship. We just want stories where you are the dominant feature of being present and active in our lives. I want to know that. I want to know that I'm a part of a church that wants that, that desires that, that hungers that, God. And I want to be a part of a church that's run like an organization that has no part God. None of us do. But that's our temptation. Father, what are you promising to us? We know that you are. Give me the courage, the thirst to search your word, to find that promise, to share it with others, to dialogue it, to chat it through, to socialize it, to talk about it. Like, is this what God is asking of us? Is this what you, God, are asking? Are you pulling us towards this? Then let's go. And it scares the living daylights out of us, but let's go. And there's no way to get that done, but let's go. And there's no human way that can ever be done, but let's go. Because you're there and you're calling us forward. Just in the same way for the individual, healing and delivery may seem impossible. And yet you stretch out your hand and say, I am here with you. Let's go. And all the people of God said,